There are dozens of would-be explanations for the polarization we as a culture and a body politic experience today. One plausible explanation that rarely been explored is nominalism, as over against realism. You're listening to The After Dinner Scholar from Wyoming Catholic College, and I'm your host, Dr. Jim Tonkowicz. Do the words we use, cat, canyon, mountain, and most important, human, describe universals or merely particulars? Can we meaningfully talk about human nature and what it means to be one of us? Is human nature something real that is outside of our thoughts, or is it merely an internal subjective construct we apply to many particulars that seem somewhat alike? While these seem like rather abstract and academic questions, Wyoming Catholic College senior Jack Thrippleton argued in his senior thesis and oration, quote, "Realism and nominalism cannot truly argue against one another, for they do not share enough premises," close quote. The conflict is obvious. Jack is our guest this week on The After Dinner Scholar. Let's begin with realism and Thomas Aquinas. What did Thomas teach about the nature of reality and about universals?
Aquinas talks about how when we look at things out in the world, what we're doing, we sense the thing with our senses, of course, and that information passes into our intellect, where the intellect extracts the essence of the thing, what makes it what it is, the whatness, so to speak, of the thing, pulls that out of the picture that it receives from the senses. And so that thing, that whatness, we call the essence, and that is, in a sense, that's really how we know everything. The things that we know because we have taken their essence into our intellect.
So it's the little kid who knows what a truck is.
Yeah.
And every truck that goes by, he points to it and says, truck. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't do that with cars or baby carriages.
Yeah, because there's something he can tell about that, right? Something that makes it this thing. Right? There's something in there that makes it that thing, right? So it's it's not just that he's seeing a bunch of things that are similar and calling them by the same name, right? Or even just saying, well, this name applies to this thing. He's saying this name applies to this type of thing, right? And that type of thing is made a type of thing by this essence.
Okay. And the essence, so the essence of truck is in all trucks.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay.
And it's the thing that makes it truck. All of the things that trucks share are there because truckness is in every truck.
Okay. And the same thing, of course, could be said of cats.
Exactly.
And most important, of human beings.
Yeah, right. Definitely.
Now, why did William of Ockham feel that he needed to improve on Thomas? What was going on between Thomas's death in 1274 and Ockham writing 50 years-ish later? Yeah.
There are a lot of historical things that happened in that interval. One of the most notable ones is that 3 years after Aquinas' death in 1277, a fairly well-meaning bishop published a list of theses that were banned from public discourse at the University of Paris. And in that list were several of the things that Aquinas taught, especially specifically things that applied to his idea of how universals and individuals interact. So, for example, Aquinas teaches that each truck has truckness in it, which is what makes them all the same type of thing. But what makes one truck different from another truck is that one truck has this matter over here filling up this space, and this other truck has a different matter filling up a different space. So this matter under the form of dimensions is what distinguishes one thing with an essence from another thing with an essence. But that explanation was one of the theses that was banned in these condemnations. It only applied to the University of Paris, but that was the intellectual center of the time. And so people tried to find other ways to explain, right? Other ways to explain what makes this cat different from that cat if they both share catness. So the ideas that were proposed to fix this problem largely just didn't work. Almost all of them didn't stick. And so when William of Ockham comes upon it, he's not really rejecting Aquinas. Aquinas has already been rejected. He's rejecting the things that were thought of when Aquinas was no longer an option. And he's saying, look, none of these work. Why are you scrambling so hard to keep this idea of universal? It's obvious that that's just not real. It's so much simpler to say, rather than being layers and layers and layers of things making these things distinct, they're just individuals. There's just a single thing without needing any extra part to be so.
So the two trucks are...
They're just two different things that happen to share a lot of similarities.
Mm-hmm.
And the name that we apply to them, according to Occam, truck, we're applying only because we see those similarities and we say, oh, well, these two things are more similar to each other than they are to a car. So I'm going to call them a truck instead, mm-hmm. because they're different and I'm going to apply this different name to them.
But it's strictly something going on in my mind.
Exactly. These ideas, these names are purely intellectual constructs for our intellectual convenience. I can talk about groups of things if I have these names that share certain qualities.
Mm-hmm.
But there's nothing fundamentally in there that I'm pulling out.
Right. Right. And of course, it doesn't matter so much with trucks, but with human mm-hmm. beings, it makes a big deal.
Yeah.
You know, what does it mean to be a human?
Mm-hmm.
About Occam's nominalism, you wrote, quote, in the new way, Occam's way, universals are from particulars. In the old way, particulars are from the true universals. Would you unpack that a little bit? We're on that track.
Go ahead. Yeah. So Aquinas will talk about how you have all of these particular things, but they are individuals of that essence. Right. So for example, a cat gets its catness from the universal of cat. It is an individual example of this essence. So every time you see a cat, it's because it has catness. It has that universal form in it. It is an example of that form. For Occam, on the other hand, the universal category, cat, doesn't exist, properly speaking. We just see a bunch of things that look kind of similar. You know, they're furry, they've got tails, they meow. And we say, well, these things have these similarities, and they're different from these other things, so we're going to call the things that share these particular similarities cat. And I'm forming this idea in my mind that has all of the things that all of the cats share, and all the things where the different cats differ, it's just sort of blurry. So I'll have the colors kind of blurred out. I'm not really thinking about that, but I'm thinking about a general shape, a general size, certain activities. But ultimately, that universal comes from the particulars. The particulars exist first.
Okay, but that means, but from Thomas's mm-hmm. point of view, if I point to a dog over in the corner and say, well, that's a cat.
Mm-hmm.
From Thomas's point of view, I've made a big mistake, and that is not a cat because it doesn't share in this catness, right?
Right.
From Occam's point of view, if I point to the dog in the corner and say, that's a cat, I mean, catness is only a construct in my mind. It need not necessarily be the same construct that's in your mind, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
That's in a sense correct. At the same time, the words that we apply to these constructs only really have power because they're shared conventionally.
Mm-hmm.
So the only reason that it means anything at all for me to say this is a cat is because you and I both have agreed, in a sense, to use that same word, cat, to apply to this idea and applying to the same group of things. So you would, however, easily run into this problem when you have things that are kind of on the border, right? If you ask most people, is a daddy long legs a spider? They'll say, yes. If you ask a biologist, they'll say, no. Spiders have two body segments. Daddy long legs only have one. So according to the proper definition, so to speak, they're not spiders, right? So something that's kind of on a weird border, or when you have a slight difference in the definitions, you can end up with that type of problem. But for the most part, it doesn't affect daily life because language being a mostly conventional thing, it has a strength in that we agree to use the same word to apply to the same general type of group.
Okay. But in your thesis, you talk about it having enormous implications. And you went on to demonstrate that in two areas where the triumph of nominalism, and it has been the triumph of nominalism, brought about major changes. And one is religion and one is politics.
Yeah.
Tell us briefly about your thoughts there and about Luther and Thomas Hobbes.
It seems at first that this distinction between nominalism and realism is just a philosopher's distinction, and it doesn't actually affect our daily life. And they both, in a way, represent how we experience life in a way that makes sense on a sort of fundamental level. At the same time, when you deny that nature's essences exist, you lose a lot of ground for talking about things in a certain way. So the entire structure of ethics, theology, politics that's put together by Aristotle and then Aquinas depends on very heavily the idea of human nature. And so if human nature isn't, strictly speaking, a thing, then you can't argue from those anymore. And you have to find some other basis for how to build your society, how to think about God. And that's going to come from your experiences of those things. So rather than saying, well, this is what man is supposed to be, we're just really bad at doing it, which is what Aristotle and Aquinas say, the Enlightenment thinkers who fall under this nominalist system tend to think of man as being what we normally experience of man, that is, a not very pleasant person who's only looking out for themselves. Because that is, by and large, what we experience, that's the only ground they really have to go on. And so the idea of the state of nature, as seen in people such as Hobbes, Locke, Rousseau, is founded in this idea of, well, this is what man looks like now. We only ever really experience fallen man. We don't know what man's supposed to be like, but this is what man is like now. And the same thing applies to theology, because if you can't say anything definitive about what God is or is not, then your theology becomes a very different type of thing. You can't really apply human reason to theology anymore. Which is why we see a divide, really, between philosophy and theology at this point in history. You're either a philosopher or a theologian, after Occam, really.
So the only thing we can know about God is what the scriptures tell us.
Precisely.
And the only thing we can know about man is what the scriptures tell us.
And what we see around us.
And what we see around us. Now, how does that realist-nominalist divide affect the world we live in today? With our enormous divisions and polarization.
Yeah, I think one way in which it very much affects us today is that people often don't realize, especially when people are first introduced to the philosophy of Aristotle and Aquinas, they don't realize that it's not just that people are ignorant of this is how the world works. People think of the world as working in a radically different way. And you can't, and again, like we were saying before, you can't really say, well, this is what man is supposed to be. Right? The closest thing we can do to saying this is in man's nature with a nominalist understanding is, do we see men doing this? Or do we see this in nature as we tend to think about nature in modern day? So you'll have people arguing that, you'll have people attempting to say, well, homosexuality is unnatural. And they'll say, no, these bugs do it, and humans do it. So it's clearly not against our nature, because we can find it in nature. It's a different understanding of what the word nature means. Really, people just are talking past each other. Even if you have two nominalists, there's no reason to suspect that they're thinking of the same things. Because while they may agree on the words, the ideas behind those words are going to be different in each case. And so there's always that possibility that what I'm talking about when I talk about a cat is actually just vastly different. I could be including mentally big cats and house cats. And you could just be thinking about house cats, for example. Mm-hmm. Right? And so you can end up in, you basically just end up not being able to have any sort of conversation whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. And so what I believe is self-evidently correct, and what you believe is self-evidently wrong. And And not only that, that you're a bad person for believing it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And at the same time, the previous people who have thought this, who are very influential, so you have Martin Luther, you have Thomas Hobbes, their philosophies have taken over. And so the idea of social contract, for example, is the prevailing way of thinking about politics. Man is profoundly not social. And the only reason we do it is because the math works out, basically. And also Martin Luther's ideas about whether we can know God, how philosophy interacts with science and theology, how those three interact. That divide has, I think, shown rather large fruits in today's time.
Well, you've broached a gigantic topic in your thesis.
Yes.
Do you have plans to follow that up with more education or?
Yes, I'm looking at continuing on into grad school for theology, either this fall or in a couple of years, depending on how things work out. And specifically looking into how what people believe and how people think affects what they do and what they write. So, for example, this person believes these things and you can see it in their writing and you can see it in their philosophy. Or this basic philosophical idea is sitting in the back of their minds. And so when they go and do this thing, even if they're not consciously thinking that, that's there. That's a premise for the syllogism in their mind that led to these actions.
As I spoke with Jack Thrippleton, I couldn't help hearing echoes of C.S. Lewis, particularly his book, The Abolition of Man. Lewis was, of course, a realist who clearly knew the difference between a belief in the real, what he called the Tao, and the nominalism and moral subjectivity he saw all around him. If this whole topic interests you, please sign up for Wyoming Catholic College's latest distance learning course, The Medieval Mind of C.S. Lewis, with Dr. Jason Baxter. Dr. Baxter will take you back before nominalism to look at how Lewis understood the world and give you a greater appreciation for all that he wrote. Visit our website, wyomingcatholic.edu, for more information and to register. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.